My name is Vince Battisti, obviously. John told you that. And yeah, I've been reading the cards for a long time, the tarot. We're talking about the tarot cards tonight. And there's a, if I started reading in 1969, so that means in 2019, I'll be able to say, I've been reading the cards for 50 years. That makes me like a paleo tarot guy, you know. I feel like, well, you know, but what comes with that, I think, is that's kind of neat, is you can see all the changes that have happened. So it's not just a matter of experience. It's a matter of seeing the changes from 69 to the present. And there's been a lot of changes. Back then, there was only one tarot deck to buy, for one. And today, probably the biggest problem people have is deciding which deck to get. There's so many different decks out there. And the meanings of the cards changed as well. A lot of the meanings were very nice meanings, and some were brutal meanings. And actually, physical death was actually one of the meanings of the cards. Can you imagine somebody going for surgery or something? I want to know, how's the surgery going to go? And the death card comes up, and he's like, well, I don't know what to tell you here. You know? So, I mean, there were brutal meanings, despair and ruin and insanity. But there was also wonderful ones. But the thing is, over time, we've taken those meanings and put them in a more constructive way of looking at things, for counseling and helping find positive answers to things we're looking into. So a lot of changes have happened. And I'd like to explain something tonight about the tarot that has never been explained before. And that's about a mystery of the tarot that's been a mystery for over 250 years. And tonight, it will no longer be a mystery. So you're basically the first group of people that have heard this about the tarot. But that's kind of cool. In 2007, I was planning on doing a talk here on the tarot. And one of the things I was doing, we scheduled the talk, and I had about 2 or 3 months to prepare it. And I went downstairs into the basement, my computer, and I just typed in some things. I was looking for some ideas for what to talk about with the tarot. And I typed in, Googled creative thinking, just to see what comes up. And I found out it was an actual psychological study, creative thinking. So I thought, oh, this is interesting. So I'm reading about it, you know. And the more I was reading about it, the more I realized that what they were talking about, I'm saying, well, I could relate to that. That's sort of like what the tarot does. That's what I do with the tarot cards. And I'm thinking, as I read on, the more and more I read, the more I saw similarities between the tarot and this psychological study called creative thinking. And I couldn't believe it. By the time I was done reading, I realized that these two applications of thought were identical. And creative thinking is a very effective way of finding answers. And it's based on the way the genius mind over time, over the years, has gone about looking for answers to problems, whether it's Da Vinci to Einstein and everybody in between. And that application is now looked into as like a format of way of structuring your thinking to look for creative ideas. And it's called creative thinking. And the more I looked into this, the more I saw it was identical to the same application of a tarot reading. And I thought, well, this is finally explained why the tarot reading has been so effective for 250 years. And that's always been the biggest mystery of the tarot. How does it work? And I couldn't believe what I found. It's just like, this is groundbreaking. So I go upstairs, Linda's making dinner. I said, Linda, I just figured out the most important thing the tarot ever had to find. We something groundbreaking here. And she said, that's nice. Dinner will be ready in about 10 minutes. Will you put some plates on? I said, no, you don't understand. She's like, are you hungry? I said, no, I'm not hungry. I just got to write a book or something now about this because I just found this information out. So that's how that started. And I ended up writing Genius of the Tarot. So anyway, who uses this creative thinking process? Creative consultants use it. And usually Fortune 500 companies will seek them out to find new ideas, better ways to service their client, their customers, or better ways to structure their merchandise or something. And they're paid a lot of money to do this. Advertising agencies use them too to find out major selling points about to whether we should put a cartoon of a tiger on our General Mills box of cornflakes to sell more cornflakes or whatever. Branches of our government use them. CIA, Pentagon, NASA uses creative consultants. And they're there to find out and problem solve, to find out ways to reach an objective that they're trying to achieve, to find new ideas. Basically, they're there to make a prediction. And it works. And that's why it's so effective. There's three mysteries to the tarot. One of them is our origin, the origin of the tarot. We don't know where it started from. Another is, what did they do with these cards? Why did they make them? Now, the origin is speculated now to be about early 15th century, 1420, somewhere around there. Italy is probably where they came from. The reason they made these cards and what they did with them is probably game playing for the elite, royal families, social gatherings. They would play with the cards. Then something happened in the late 18th century. The tarot started to be associated with the occult. And it was used to make predictions. This is around 1770. Names like Alliet and Gebelin were two of the first professional tarot readers there ever was. And they predicted futures with tarot cards, claiming that the cards had some power to do this. And this caught on. And 300 years later, 250 years later, almost 250 years later, here we are today, and that's still the biggest mystery of the tarot. How can a deck of cards predict future? What powers does a deck of cards have? And there's a lot of speculation on what they are. Maybe there's some mysterious powers in the cards that linger around cards, or maybe the cards get in touch with our higher self and relay messages to us, or spirit guides have been said to be used. But none of these things can be confirmed. And the deepest occultist in the tarot to the most biggest authorities on the tarot today still admit we don't know why they work. And that's been the big mystery. And today we're going to find out why they work. And I'd like to explain there's a few different ways of, there's a couple different trains of thought with psychology, two different trains of thought that we need to look into. One of them is productive thinking, and the other one is reproductive thinking. When you're born with productive thinking. Everything is a question mark. You know, what's this? What's this over here? Nothing's off the table. You believe in the tooth fairy, the Easter bunny, everything is real. And you have an imagination that's amazing. And then as you experience life, you start to acquire reproductive thinking ideas. Reproductive thinking is what has worked in the past will work again for this problem I'm looking into, whatever it happens to be. Reproductive thinking. Our school systems work with reproductive thinking. We're told explicit ways of formulas to solve problems, how to memorize answers, and it's very beneficial, it's very important. But what it does is it represses our productive thinking as we do this. So the more we gain reproductive thinking, the less productive thinking we have in our arsenal of thinking. What happens with reproductive thinking is if I'm looking to solve a problem and I can't find an answer, I become stuck now because I'm looking for a new answer here. You cannot will a new idea to come to you. So you're stuck. You just have no way of finding an answer. And that's where we run into trouble. Genius minds, the thing, what makes a genius is not their IQ. It's nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with the fact that a genius, as they experiencing life, they retain their productive thinking qualities as well. They don't repress them. They don't lose them. So they have both. And that's what makes them so special. I think Einstein's one whose imagination is more important than knowledge, along with many other wonderful things he said. And that's true. So the genius mind always has that in their mind for new ideas. Einstein also said, was asked, what's the difference between you and a normal, average person's way of thinking? He said, if you ask an average person to find a needle in a haystack, they will look in the haystack until they find a needle, and then they stop. He says, I will look through the complete haystack and find every kind of needle that's in it. And that's the difference between the two. And that makes sense. So how do we force ourselves back into productive thinking when we're in this mindset of reproductive thinking and we need to find a new idea? We have systems for that now. And productive thinking. To find a new idea, we need to force ourselves out of reproductive thinking. And there's an application of thought to do that now, and that's what's used by these creative consultants that I was talking about to find ideas. It forces us out of reproductive thinking and puts us in productive thinking. And the best way to do that is to, first we map out the question into elements, specific elements of concern to whatever we're looking into. This is very typical of great thinkers throughout history. They've done this. It's easier to correct or change or modify a specific element of whatever it is you're looking into as a question than to keep looking at your question as a whole and try to change something in it. So to find some little detail thing that's very significant and just modify that is a lot easier to do. So the first thing we do is you map out the question into sections, elements that pertain to the question. If it was something simple, let's say I wanted to open up a coffee house, and I'm going to decide to have four elements of my question. So I would maybe have location being one element. Hours of operation might be another. How would I serve the coffee, whether I have tables and chairs inside or just strictly carry out? And what kind of coffee would I have? Maybe espresso, cappuccino, or just regular and decaf. Now I have four elements to my question of a coffee house. Now I can look into each one of these elements and fine-tune something or structure something here to make it special and really good. And the way you do this is so that part of the question is not that hard to figure out. You could still use reproductive thinking to do that. You could take your question apart and break it off into sections. You can do that. But now when you have those sections, now you got to get creative. What are you going to do to find answers to ways to modify or improve one of these elements? The easiest way we know how to do that is to add a random stimulus to the element of the question. And what we do is we add the random stimulus to an element, and we look at what attributes does this randomness have that would help modify, change, substitute, reverse, enable, eliminate, or something to that element of my question in some way that would make it useful for what I'm looking to do. This is called conceptual blending, and we've been doing it since the beginning of time. Conceptual blending is taking some thing that's just laying around and saying, well, what attributes does this have for what I'm looking into? The time, when we first picked up a rock as a cave person, said, I can use this to skin this carcass that I found to eat meat on, out of or something. That's conceptual blending. Rocks are laying around all over the place. But the final reason to use it is conceptual blending. There's a movie called 2001 Space Odyssey, which I can tell a lot of you people would know, and some of you people were never even here when it came out. But it's 1968, I think, is when it came out. And in the beginning of that movie, it was the first high-priced sci-fi movie, I think it was, out at the time. And in the beginning of that movie, Stanley Kubrick, who also did The Shining, did that movie. Beginning of the movie, it shows the dawn of man, it says. You think, well, this is a space movie, what's this about? And it shows a couple of cave people, ape-like creatures, and they're walking around. They're just getting by. They're just doing whatever they have to do. And one of them is looking at a skeleton of a boar, and he's looking for, seems to scrap some meat by it, and there isn't any. So he picks up a femur bone, and he's just banging on it. And then he's thinking, you know, and he takes the bone and he starts banging on the skeleton, and he crashes the head of this thing in with his femur bone, and it shows in his mind the idea of a boar falling bludgeoned dead. And he's got it. He's got this idea. I can use this as a tool. And he throws it up in the air, and it's going up and up and up and up and up, and all of a sudden it turns into a spacecraft. And it's Strauss music going, and it's orbiting a planet. And what Kubrick was trying to show is that everything we do, from the time we were cave people up till now, we've been using conceptual blending for everything that's invented. And that's what we've been doing. Examples of that would be space, the Hubble telescope was almost 86th. They almost quit trying to figure out how to do it. They had a think tank on it, a bunch of conceptual consultants working on it. They couldn't, one of the elements of that question, that objective they were trying to do, was how are they going to focus this thing when it got into space? They couldn't figure out how they were going to make it work. And one of the consultants was at a conference about this project, and he was in his hotel room, and he decided to take a shower. So he gets in the shower, and he's adjusting the shower head in this hotel room. And he's looking at the way the shower head would adjust to make the stream of water adjusted to fine mist to direct stream of water. It would oscillate. And that was, he got the idea there. That's what you needed for this telescope. So conceptually blending a random stimulus of a shower head to adjust the focus of the Hubble telescope is how it was done. Galileo always wanted to find an accurate timekeeping device. They didn't need it so much on land, but they needed it to navigate longitude at sea. So this was a real important thing. And they didn't have one. So he was in church one day, probably bored, and he's watching the priest swing this incense-filled thurible on a long chain back and forth, and he's doing the mass, Domini Domini, or whatever. And he's looking at that thurible. And from that thurible, he came up with the idea, the theory of the pendulum clock, which went on to be the most accurate timekeeping device until the 20th century. From conceptually blending a random stimulus of things you find in a church, to particularly, specifically this thurible, to a mechanism of keeping time. One other quick example of that would be Pentagon wanted to find an air-to-air missile that could hit a target effectively. So their thinking crew, they had on that, they had certain elements about how they're going to make this missile. This was in the 60s. And one of the key elements that was had to be looked into was how are they going to aim this thing to hit another high-speed jet? And so the head of that thinking crew told everybody, think of things you find in the desert. A random stimulus, things you find in the desert. You find cactus, you find sand, you find sun, you find rattlesnakes. And the sidewinder rattlesnake in the desert is the most typical rattlesnake in the desert. And it seeks out its prey by heat sensors around its eyes. So it seeks out, it senses body heat before it strikes. And they thought with the attribute of the rattlesnake, the sidewinder, using that in aiming our missile, and they came up with the first heat-seeking missile, and it was called the Sidewinder for that reason. Conceptual blending. We use it for everything. Even smaller things. A creative consultant was asked by a cutlery company, I think it was. So we need a better can opener. We want a can opener. And he said, okay, well, he's thinking about things. And he, so he thought of things you find in a garden, which has nothing to do with can openers, which is what you do want. You want something random. And he came up with the pea pod. And the pea pod has a natural seam on the edge of it. And you crack it open and you grab the peas out of it. And he thought, well, instead of a better can opener, why don't we make a better can? And if anybody owns a pet cat, you know what I'm talking about. You got those cat pads and you got to just pop them open. Well, thanks to him and that pea pod, we're not using a can opener every day with that can of cat food. So this is used a lot. What was interesting about this is it's the same exact application. This is called conceptual blending. A random stimulus into a question gives us new ideas. The same application happens with a tarot reading. We have a position of a card spread. A card spread might have 10 positions in it. Each position is an element of your question. The random stimulus is a tarot card that's associated to that element of the question. What attributes does this tarot card have that could be used to answer this element of my question? Conceptual blending, the same exact thing. Why we never see this in a card reading for 250 years is because you never see the card reading. You never see the card spread, I should say. The most important part of the application of a card spread, of card reading, is the spread itself. The card spread is a collection of elements or issues that directly pertain to your question. They're supposed to be questions about your questions. They're like chapters of your question. The cards are just a random stimulus that are laid into each one of those positions to get ideas. Deck of tarot cards is a deck of, it's an idea generator. 78 cards with dreamlike images and vague interpretations can mean anything. So it's the same exact application. The only difference between a creative thinker and a card reader is the card reader limits their creative thinking random stimulus to a deck of 78 cards, where the creative thinker uses the world and anything in it. Things found in a desert, things found in a bathroom, things found in a church, things found in a garden. Anything. They're the same. Creative thinking application, random stimulus to a question, a card. And like I said before, the card spread itself, we don't ever see it. We don't see the positions of a card spread. Unless you're reading about it in a book, you'll see it diagrammed out. And a lot of authors really run into trouble with trying to write about what we're doing with it. And they'll say, here's an elements of a question, and here's a horseshoe. This is a horseshoe card spread. Very popular spread, 7 positions. And you'll see that each one of these positions represents an element of a question. Now, the horseshoe card spread is a template set of issues. This is meant to be able to help us with any question we're looking into. So they're very vague or general elements to our question. The issue, present influence, outside influence, an option, hopes and fears, near future, possible outcome. Taking our issue, whatever it is, I'm separating it into 7 elements. And a lot of authors will say, this card, when they're talking about position 1, they'll say, this card represents the issue. Position 2, they'll say, this card represents the present influence, and so on. But that's not really the case. These positions, these elements are there. They're a part of this reading. The card is to be associated with those elements. They are not the element itself. Knowing that, if we know that's the way it works, there's a separation between the position element or the position and the card. This allows us to realize that we can change these elements to anything we want to change them. We don't have to have them where this is going to be the issue and this is going to be present info. We can put whatever we want in there if we have the time to do that. Now, most professional readers don't. There's always a time element. So you're paying for 15 minutes or half an hour for a reading, and then there's somebody else coming out. And after that, we can't take a lot of time to create elements of your question. So we go with a template of elements. I go with what, why, how, and when. Those 4 elements, I think, can be helpful in any question being looked into. But you can change them to whatever you want them to be. And so you never see the card spread itself. And because of that, it was always hard to detect. And people will say, what gives these cards such a powerful ability of insight to make predictions? And they're looking at the cards. They're saying, what do these cards do? What are these cards? You know, they're looking at the cards, and they study the symbolism of the cards, and because they could hold them in their hands. You know, they can see these cards. You never see the card spread. You don't see the card spread until the cards are laid into it. The reader knows those positions by heart. He knows what they mean. But you don't see it. All you see is the cards that are laid into it. And because of this, we look at the cards. This has been a big misdirection. It's like the cards are saying, keep looking at me and you'll never know my mystery. Because you're not looking at this. You're looking at this deck of cards. The cards are just a random stimulus, a very important part. Well, it's an important part of a creative thinking process, but you could use something else there too. You could use things found in your top dresser drawer. You know, broken wristwatch, tie clip, and clothespin, or whatever. Those things could be used too. But the cards are really a wonderful way to do it. So that has been the obstacle for the people to see how this works, because it's really hidden. You don't see the positions of a card spread. All you see is the cards. But this is really what it looks like. Those positions, we don't see them on the table, we see the cards. But the position and the element are working together. The card is not the element. It works with the element. It's an attribute to be combined and conceptually blended randomly to the element. Now, you could find random stimulus anywhere. One of the places you could find it is a very common one to find is just taking a book and just fanning it and put your finger on a page. Stop the book, and then whatever word your finger's on is a random stimulus. That's one way. Things found in this room is another. There was a good movie called, I brought this up once before, I think in the first talk I did here, called The Usual Suspects with Kevin Spacey. You know the one I'm talking about. Okay. And Kevin Spacey's in a, he's being arrested or he's a suspect. And the whole movie is around his interrogation. And he's a real slick guy in this. And so as the detective is interrogating him, he's looking around in the detective's office and stuff in his billboard stuff. And the detective's drinking a cup of coffee. He sees the bottom of the coffee cup. He sees the stamp of the coffee cup maker. And he's creating this elaborate story by all these things in his office, just this random stuff in his office. He creates this elaborate story. And at the end, he's set free because it was so convincing. And then the detective realizes afterwards that, oh my gosh, no, what he's... I see what he did now. But anyway, it was a very good example of random stimulus being used to create something. And he did a good job with that. So where does this lead us? Conclusions on things. If we look at the card reading now as something that's not mysterious. It's something that can be improved. It's something, if we know what we're doing with it. We've done paint-by-numbers type of card readings for 250 years here because we didn't know why it worked. And that's basically, if you don't know why something's worked, you can't change it. So we've been forced to do step-by-step. And I teach the tarot. People will tell me, is this position one? We start over there. It doesn't make any difference. We don't have to be that exact with what we're doing here. Once we understand what we're doing, we see that. If we never understood the combustible engine and Henry Ford died, if he created it, I think he did, we would have to reproduce Model Ts exactly like he said, exactly the same way, and every part would be reproduced, and we would assemble the Model T exactly the same way. And everybody today would have been driving here 100 years later in an exact Model T like Henry Ford had, because we don't know why it works. And that's what we've done with these cards. Now we know why it works. And it's not a theory. We could look at creative thinking, which is a bigger industry than tarot cards are, and say, well, what are you doing? And you can go to college, you take college courses on it. And you'll see it's the same exact thing we're doing with these cards. Once we understand what it is we're doing and why it works, now we can change it to whatever we want to change it to. These elements don't have to be whatever the horseshoe spread says they are. They can be whatever I want to put in there. If I want to take the time to try to think of elements that would be pertaining to my question more closely than these would. What we've done is we've been saying, okay, well, this card spread's elements don't really work for me, so I'm going to find a different card spread with different elements in it that maybe do work. Maybe the Celtic cross does, or the horoscope spread does, or one of the other spreads has the different elements, meanings in it. Well, that's like the tail wagging the dog. I could just take these elements and just change them wherever I want. If I want hopes and fears, I want to be Tom. I could put that in there. I could just put the name of a person in there. Or whatever I want to put in here, I can put in here. Knowing this helps us in the future, I think, will help us with what we do with card readings. In the Essential Tarot, I took the three-card spread, which is past, present, and future. And I took that, which is a very boring card spread. Who cares about past, present, and future, really, you know? And I changed it to a random element factor of 216 different elements for three positions. With one dice, you just roll it and find out which position you use. I don't have a diagram of it here, but it's just because we understand now what it is we're doing. So this new insight really opens up doors of new thought that we've never even scratched the surface of yet. We haven't even looked. We're just starting out with it. And I think it'll go beyond even tarot cards themselves. I think we'll find other random stimulus that we won't even need the tarot cards after a while. They already have angel cards. Maybe that'll be the thing. I don't know. But I'll always be a tarot reader. I don't want to be anything else. And they'll dig my grave with an ace of spades, I swear to God. I will, you know. But I do feel that in 15 years or so from now, we won't even recognize what we're seeing with these cards. It'll be something different. And it'll be a lot better. Because really, the mystery of the tarot isn't in the tarot cards. It's in the mind. And we're just finding out about how to use applications to force ourselves into thinking with a creative way of thought, like we showed just here with conceptual blending. We know what that is now. It's been around since the Neanderthal guys were walking around, but we know what it is and how it works now, so we can use it and understand it. And I think it's going to be a real interesting future. 250 years of doing it the way we're doing it, I think the next 100 years you're not going to recognize it.
Vince, can you give an example of the what you've explained, like with one of the cards, how something that may give us a better understanding of the difference?
Sure. As far as what we do in the cards with now, what we've been using the cards with, and now with a different way of looking at it, I'd have to say that the cards in the past have been, we've been taught to memorize specific meanings of the cards, and that's what the card means. But really, the card is just there to give us ideas. And so if I'm looking at the Hermit card, which I use in my Genius of the Tarot, I use this example. If I'm looking at the Hermit card, maybe the traditional meaning of the Hermit card is solitude, inner searching, loneliness, or things like this might be in there. But if I'm looking at it and I want to open up a restaurant, and I get the Hermit card, how can the Hermit card help me? Well, I can look at this card and say, well, the Hermit card, I don't have a picture of him, but he's holding a lantern like this. And Led Zeppelin's first album, I think, has on there. And so I could look at that lantern as a marquee sign to a 24-hour diner off a major expressway. And I can see the hermits wearing heavy clothes, garments, a robe. So I could see, well, this must be in the northern part of the country, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, somewhere around there. And I could see the hermit's holding a wooden staff. And I say, well, okay, look for northern region of the country, off a major expressway with a marquee sign, that's for sale, near paper mills. A lot of paper mills up that way. So you could use this card in any way it gives you ideas. You don't have to use what you memorize in a book as far as the definition goes. If I ask you to think of a picture of a rose, and then we could hook a computer or a printer to your head and print out your picture, all of us will have a different picture of that rose. And that's the same with the cards. You'll have a different meaning of the card. I work with a lot of professional tarot readers, and we do fairs yearly and things like this. Maybe you have 15 of you sitting at a fair for 4 days. And every one of them reads differently. Nobody reads the same. And we all know that about each other. So it's okay, like, you know, we'll talk and stuff, but nobody criticizes anything about it. We just all see the cards differently. So there's no any real specific way to see it. The best way to see it is how you want to see it, what it does for you. So I would say, without showing actual cards on the screen, I would say the best way to look at the cards is whatever you're seeing in the card is what the card means. And I would try to stay away from memorizing sentences out of a book about what the card means.
There's one question from someone watching online. I understand that the major trumps were invented by court astrologers around 1450. So how does astral symbolism play into the card's meaning?
That's hard to say. If you look at the Visconti Chorza deck, that was 1450, somewhere right around there. The cards had no meaning to them. They had no titles on them. They had no inscriptions of what the card was. So there was no magician card or high priestess card. There was no number one major arcana, number two. The hermit card wasn't called the hermit, wasn't called anything. It was just a picture. That's how the cards are set up. And you can still buy that deck today, the Visconti Chorza. So where we got our meanings, I think we got them in a lot of different directions. Do any of them really confirm anything? I don't really think so. I think if you look at, if you talk to about Aleister Crowley's Thoth deck, he claims this came from the Egyptian god Thoth. If you look at the Rider-Waite deck, that was the mystical order that Waite was in, has something to do with that, the way he made that deck. So the astrological symbols of the tarot back in the Middle Ages, who knows what they were thinking? I don't have a clue. But it's a good question. And it's probably, there's probably some interesting things out there about it. But I couldn't tell you where the majors came from. I don't think we have any, I know we still don't really know exactly how they, why they came into play. We do know one thing, the minor arcana, your playing cards came from the minor arcana, and there's four court cards in the tarot's minor arcana, four suits, ace through ten, four court cards, king, queen, jack, and king, queen, knight, and page. Sometime in history, they got rid of the knights, and they renamed the page Jack. Jack was an apprentice. If you were an apprentice, if you were Jack Blacksmith or Jack Carpenter, that meant you were an apprentice. And the suits were changed too, from swords to spades and so on. And there was one major arcana still with the playing card deck that we use today. And that's the Joker, who is the Fool. The most important major arcana deck in the card in the deck. And that's just a custom for some reason. But I hope that answers something.
If there's no one here with a question, there's somebody at home with another question. Can tarot cards be read effectively without the aid of clairvoyance?
Yes, I'd say that they can be. I'm a clairvoyant. I don't think I mentioned that. I'm a psychic, I'm a clairvoyant. I also have out-of-body experiences. But that has nothing to do with reading the tarot cards. The tarot cards can be read, for one thing, we could all be clairvoyant, we could all be any of these things. I don't think it's a gift. So psychic awareness, I think, is anything, we could all have that. And some people are better than others, just like some people are better playing a piano than others. It's gonna come to you easier. But as far as the tarot goes with clairvoyance, I think the only advantage of being a tarot reader, if you're trying to develop psychic awareness of any kind, is the confirmation you have with somebody that you're reading. You could look at them, you could try to see an aura around them. And maybe I don't see an aura around you, but then my next person, I see an aura around you. Was that the lighting was the same? It must have been the person's energy was different. So with your reading cards, you have a constant feedback from people. When you're up on a mountain being a hermit trying to develop your psychic awareness, there's nobody around to get feedback from. So it's harder to do it alone, where the card reader is getting constant feedback on their feelings of insight and things that they're seeing or hearing or perceiving from the client. Yes.
All right. I think that when you're a tarot reader, when you're reading for a client and these days, you know, in the 21st century, there are things that are that our clients are going to be asking that probably weren't part of the imagery of the cards that we're reading. For example, online relationships and corporate ladders and things like that. How do you interpret? How do you adapt your interpretation to the cards, these older cards, for today's clients?
That's a good question. And you use whatever you can. And I like to use keyword meanings with my card meanings. If I say this card means change, we could all think of words that branch off from the word change. So it's better than a 3 or 4 sentence definition of what the card means. The more you define something, the more limitation you put on the card. The more you're stating it's exactly this, that means it's only that. So I think keeping your definitions looser helps them stay fluid for one situation or another situation, or what element they're laid into for one question or for another question. If the cards are... Here's a trick with the tarot. Now, usually this question comes up. So this might help answer your question. Somebody will say, what you're saying makes sense, but I've seen the cards work. I've seen it get a card reading, and the cards are laid out exactly the perfect cards for my reading. There's something to that. How can a deck know exactly the perfect cards here? And the reading turned out to be true. It was predicted, and it worked. There's something had to be explainable with that. And my answer to that is it's like a Copperfield trick. There's 78 tarot cards. And each one of those 78 tarot cards can be laid into any element of any question and fit perfectly. They all work anywhere they're laid, if the reader knows how to read them. So you never see a reader say, that card doesn't make any sense to me there. You know, and so sometimes it's imagery, sometimes it's an actual meaning, sometimes it's a meaning that drifts off into another meaning from you, sometimes because there's a card laid next to it. Here's an example of an image that can help you. Young guy comes to me, wants to know if he's going to get a job as a working on a cruise ship, on a cruise liner. Good-looking guy, 25 years old, single, got the world. He's got ready to go. And he's going to have mass interviewing downtown Chicago, where they just come up to you, ask you a question. You fit in, I'm going to write your name down, you. And then they'll call 1 out of 100 or 2 out of 100 and they'll for a more better interview. So he asked me, am I going to get the job? I said, well, of course you're going to get the job. I'm going to tell him, no, you're not going to get the job. Don't bother. You know? So, yeah, of course you're going to get. Go down there and knock him out, you know. And he had these wristbands on his arm from carpal tunnel. And I didn't think anything of it. He went down there, and a month later he comes back. He says he didn't get the job. And he was still wearing those wristbands. And I said, were you wearing those wristbands when you went for that job? He said, yeah. He said, I would wear them. He says, doctor wants me to leave mine for another month or something. I said, well, are they going to have another interview downtown? He says, yeah, they're going to have another one. I said, go to that one and take those wristbands off. The reason I said that is because I'm looking at the chariot card. And here's this charioteer in the chariot, and he's these armor wristlets on his wrist, holding the reins of a charioteer. And I saw those, on his wrist. I said, that's the reason you didn't get the job. These people are going like this. And they see that, they see confusion. They don't want to bother with that. They're going to go to you. I said, take those things off your wrist, go back down. He said, well, they already saw me once. They don't want to do that. They saw me. I said, who cares if they saw you? Go down there and do it again. He did. He got the job. He got hired on tour for the Hawaiian Islands for a Norwegian high-class cruise liner. Because I saw the armor on the chariot card, and I saw those on his wrist, and that's an association, and otherwise he would have never gone back. So that might help explain something.
I wanted to ask about the client posing a question. Do you help the client reframe the question in another way?
Okay, that's a good question. A client, when you're a when you buy a deck of tarot cards and you just want to play with tarot cards, you're going to buy the cards, you're going to go home, and your friends and you're going to play around with them. When you're a professional reader, people come and pay you money not to play around with the cards. They have a specific issue on mind that they want an answer for. They're more than willing to talk to you about that and tell you exactly what it is, because this is also something that's out of their control, because if it was in their control, they wouldn't be paying you $50 to fix it for them. They would just go take care of it. So to rephrase their question, sometimes it helps. I'd like to look into what, why, how, and when. Those are the four aspects. If you could answer those four aspects of any question asked of you consistently every time, you'd be richer than Donald Trump and Bill Gates combined. So what is your real question is what I ask people. You know, they might be going through, I'm working a lot of overtime, I'm trying to get a job, I'm trying to get a promotion. I'm trying to do that. Because why do you want to do that? Well, because I want to get a raise. Why do you want to get a raise? Well, I want to be happy at my job. A raise isn't going to make you happy on your job. Maybe you need to just find a different job. So that would be, but usually they don't want to hear that. Well, I can't find another job. This is my career. I went to college to learn how to do this. This is what I want to do. I'm a slave. Let my people go. And so you can't, lots of times people don't want to hear it. But lots of times they will. So usually they don't want you to rephrase their question, but you can suggest it. You can say, are you sure you want to, this is what you want to do? So yeah, you can rephrase their question. And sometimes it's helpful. But one thing you'll find is people are very cooperative with telling you what they feel their question is and what's looking for help.
Vince, can you give us about two or three, maybe four questions that you ask your clients not to ask? that are not fair questions for a reader.
Yeah. I don't believe in spells. I don't believe in soulmates. I don't believe in spirit guides, guardian angels, things like that. I don't say that they don't exist. I mean, if there's soulmates, I got one sitting right there by my books. But I can't prove that they exist. I can't prove past lives that you were Cleopatra or Napoleon or something. So I don't like to go into those types of readings because I can't prove them. If you want to know if you're going to sell your house by September, now we got something to look into. And if September 1st, you're going to know if my prediction was right or wrong. That I like to read like that. And I'll tell people, I'll read, if you want, I'll read that. If you want to know if what you were in a past life, yeah, you were Joan of Arc, okay. If you think so, maybe you were. I try not to do it. I had a woman come up to me once for a reading. She asked me, she said, I think I just met my soulmate, so I want you to ask my guardian angels if it was my soulmates. I said, Miss, I don't believe in angels. And she said, oh, they're there. She said, just ask them. Well, now I got the squirrel telling the wolf how to hunt. She's going to tell me what to believe in and how to, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, they do? Okay. So, I mean, I should have just said, okay. And I should have just said, oh, I'm looking here. Your guardian angels tell me, no, that's not your soulmate. Then she would have thought, well, he's no good a reader. I'm going to go to somebody else, you know. But she, so I just said, well, look, I said, if there's guardian angels out there, I said, there's people there's 15,000 children die every day of starvation on the planet, on the other side over here. And so I would rather have my guardian angel fly over there with a bowl of rice for one of those kids than worry about if I just found my soulmate. And she left. So, but it's true. And so if there are guardian angels, God bless them. And one's been great to me because I'm 63 years old and I'm still here. But I don't live my life trying to believe in those things. Spells is another thing I don't believe in. So if they want me to do a spell for them, like a love spell, I say, if you love this guy and I do a love spell for you so he loves you back, well, what happens if another woman comes to me next week who wants a spell on the same guy, and now I got to do a love spell, and this guy's going to go, I don't know what happened. I used to love you, but now I love her. You know, I'm sorry, I got to go. You know, so I mean, does it really work? I don't think it works. And so why waste your time with those things? I like the things, if they can be proven, I like to read that way. And that's a prediction. I let people know it's a prediction. Predictions could be wrong, but I got a pro batting average. So that means I'm going to be wrong, but they're going to be, most of the time, hopefully right.
What about if somebody asks you to predict something like, will Trump be our next president?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, I know some people here didn't know about that. Here's
how do you handle it?
With an open mind. You know, you let them know, well, I don't like to do world issues, for one thing, because I'm just a person. I can't decide, I can't visualize what's going to happen, something like that. So I'll tell them, probably, I have never had anybody come to me and pay me money to want to know that. And that's probably why they're going to pay money to know that, no. Unless it was Donald Trump's wife or something, you know, which I don't think is going to happen. But I tell you what I did do, though. When Gore ran against Bush, 2000, I had a real bad feeling that one of them was going to be assassinated. Now, I don't want to sound like a kook, so I'm not going around saying, oh, one of them is going to be assassinated. But I read after this that there was a curse in 1840 on Harrison. I think it was General Harrison.
1860.
You got it. McKinley, all of them. Every time an election ended with a zero, that person didn't survive office. Lincoln and Kennedy and all the way up to Reagan. And he was shot. But he was the Teflon president, so he, you know, curses didn't bother him. You know, and then 18 or the year 2000, Gore was the popular vote elected president, but he didn't make the White House. So if I ever saw Gore, I was going to say, you know what? It's probably good you didn't get in there, because you might have been shot. I don't believe in superstitions, but as far as world events, I try to stay out of them. Other than just game playing. I did say that Hillary Clinton is going to beat Donald Trump in the election before I even thought that those two were going to be running again. I was for Bernie Sanders. Look at that. But I think that's a huge prediction. And so what's funny is that looks like they're going to be running. I don't really feel that I have any ability to predict that, though. So I think that was just a lucky call, if it happens.
I've seen you do readings, and I want to know how you decide the timing on when something's going to happen when you look at the cards. Like, sometimes you've told me 3 months, sometimes it's been the month of June. I don't know how you decide that.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. Now, it depends on what. I use a Celtic cross, not the horseshoe. This was just good for a diagram to show how a card spread works. And in the number six position of my Celtic cross, that is the timing position, something coming up in the near future. And I usually look at that as the three-month period. To me, 3 months just seem to work. And some people might say a month for them, maybe a whole year, within the next year, meaning from today till next year. I like to think of it from today to 3 months from now, any time within there. Unless it's a specific, let's say it was a Seven of Cups. I might say, well, the seventh month of next month, or that would be July. I might say that too. So it really depends on the person, the question, and how I feel. If it's the Moon card, I might say next month, because the Moon has cycles a month. But usually I did like to keep that as a 3-month space of time. Now, if somebody's taking an exam tomorrow and they want to know if they're going to pass, well, then obviously 3 months is not, we're talking tomorrow. So that card is for tomorrow. So it does depend on their question. Lots of times their question will have a time frame in it, so you know. But if it doesn't, you just sort of see what comes to you about it.
How often do you ask your clients to weigh in on the symbolism that you're seeing in a certain card? For example, the dogs in the moon card. So you know, you may see that and you think, good dogs. You know, the dogs they're pointing at, you know, they're looking down the road. Your client may be terrified of dogs. Do you know what I mean? I mean, and it's their reading. Do you see any kind of a conflict or a way to resolve that?
Yeah, I do. And usually what, if you tell them something good, they want to believe you. They want to believe you. So if you say, well, these are good dogs, you know, they say, oh, good, okay, it's a good dog. I did a family party once. It was anything from grandmothers to young kids, two sides of the family. And so it was quick stuff. It was popcorn readings, they call them. You got 5-minute reading, 10-minute reading, something like that. Just grab the next person. And so I have this grandma. And she's older, you know. And she comes in for a reading. I set her down. And she's just real quiet. She's listening. She says, and all she really wanted to know was about her grandchildren. She didn't have nothing really to talk about. She's just going along with the flow. So I'm reading her, and then I'm done with her reading. Okay. I said, okay, hope you like that. I put my cards all up. I got them all in my hand again. She says, oh, I got one more question. She says, could you tell me about my health? I said, okay, and I just took one card and I threw it down. It was the death card. I said, one card, all 78, happy that one. And she just looks at it, she looks at me, and she looks at me, I said, you're gonna be fine. I picked up the card, and I walked out. She didn't say nothing. So that was that.
I wanna make a statement. One person asked about how you would possibly take a deck of older tarot cards and work with a question that is in life now, in current situation. Well, the Essential Tarot book for every card, he has that in here, the explanations of how you could apply the creative thinking to like an older deck. So you could expand with the creative thinking. So just so you know,
well,
that's
thank
in there.
You. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, what I try to do with my books is I want them to, I want you to look, I don't want to tell you what the card means. It's hard to write a book about tarot cards to try to get you to see the cards through your own eyes and not mine. And I try to do that. So I try to write, this is what I'm seeing, but you can see something else and that's okay. But here's some suggestions on what I'm seeing here and here's the tools I use for it. And in that particular book, because of that, I use a deck from the 1800s, as well as the Rider-Waite, which is a very popular tarot deck. It showed, so the Eight of Cups, 1800s, and then Eight of Cups, Rider-Waite, showed them side by side, and how they both can mean the same thing. And so you get a range. The image doesn't really make a difference, whether it's from the 1800s or from the 1900s, it doesn't really make a difference. And that's why I did that. They're all connected. If you were to map out the meanings of the cards and put them on a big sheet of paper and just fine branched meanings as it drifts from one word to another, to another, to another, all these cards would all be interacting and connected to each other anyway. Michael Gelb wrote, How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci. He endorsed my book, Genius of the Tarot, Creative Thinker. And he said, if you were to take a mind map, which is a visual illustration of a thought that you're thinking of, and just keep branching it out and keep branching out, eventually it would cover everything in the world. So it just keeps on drifting, just keeps on going. The same with the cards. They can just keep on endlessly going with meaning.
Yeah, Vince, I mean, there are different ways that you could look at tarot. I mean, there's a stereotypical way of looking at it where the gypsy's like telling your fortune. But with you, I mean, I know that some psychotherapists actually use the cards in their counseling sessions. Do you have more of that approach in your readings? Clarification of issues? And you're not a psychologist, you're not a psychotherapist, but...
No.
But I think there could be a certain dimension of counseling involved in the...
Yes.
In the readings as far as clarifying issues or maybe presenting options for the client.
Right. We know some counselors. And yes, I'm not a certified counselor. But life experience has a lot to do with it. So I think being my age... helps a lot with my seeing an issue. Plus, you see patterns. You see the same issue. It's funny. When I teach the tarot, the minor arcana, ace through 10, is a cycle, a pattern, and it shows in the cards. And when you take, aces stand for new beginnings. Twos are a choice. So you take a new beginning. Do I want a relationship? And then you decide to choose, yes, twos, two of swords. Then you decide, from there, if you decide yes, then you create the relationship. Because threes are creative energy. Fours are stability. So fours, after you create the energy, the relationship, now you stabilize it. Then after stabilizing, fives are next. Fives are change. The only thing that can come is, well, the fives look bad, because it comes right after the stable fours. Anything that changes with this is now not a good thing. This is where challenges with marriage and things like this can happen. But sixes are you overcome obstacles. You pick yourself up and you get through it, and you move on. Sevens, because of that, you get more confidence in yourself. You see what you can do. Eights, you advance forward into more in life. Nines, you attain what you're trying to attain. And tens are a completion. Ace through 10, all those things happen. I don't care if you're brushing your teeth or getting involved with a relationship. First you have the thought, you go and you do it, you prepare everything, and you do it. And so when somebody comes to you for a reading, they're usually in the fives, change. Not a very good spot to be in. So you know where they've been, and you know where they're going. You already know that. If they're in the tens, there's no reason to come to you for a reading, because everything's going great. And the nines the same way. So they're usually in a difficult spot. Or they're in the fours and they're bored to death. You know, and they're running out. So because of that, I do feel that you see a lot of patterns with people. It's amazing how we all have very similar problems, or challenges, I should say. They're all the same. And there's a lot of lonely people out there, so relationship, and that's always a big one with the card reader anyway, relationship. So I might have somebody sits here wants to know, you know what, when you're in high school, you're dating, you got the prom, you got homecoming and all these. Now I'm out of high school, I'm divorced for 5 years and I don't know how to meet anybody. And I don't know how to meet anybody. I don't want to go on the dating sites. I say, well, just sit right there. I feel like just tell them, just stay right there. Well, by the end of the day, I'm going to find somebody who's looking for the same thing you're looking for, and I'm going to introduce you. Because everybody's looking for the same thing. You could walk in a shopping mall, and you don't have to be psychic. I think you could all do this. You could probably just see it in people's eyes. Walk into a shopping mall and just walk, and you see the people as you're walking by them. A lot of lonely people. You feel like just coming to them and saying, I know he's lonely. Why don't we have a cup of coffee? You know, I mean, that's, you almost feel like saying that. But if you did, they would think you're nuts. So you can't say that, because we don't do that in society. But you see it. And I don't think that it's a psychic awareness. I think we could all see that. They say 93% of what we communicate to others is nonverbal. That means we only communicate to our others through speaking by 7%. Everything else is body language and the way you stand and the way you look and your expressions. So you can see it in people. So being a counselor, in a way, that's what you're doing. But I think a lot of that just comes from experience.
I'm just wondering then if you find a negative interpretation in the cards, do you try and put a positive spin on it, or are you okay with letting it be negative?
Okay, that's a good question. If you find a negative in a card, a negative card, I look at it as a warning and what can be avoided, try to avoid, something to watch for. I don't believe in fate. I believe in free will more than anything. So if I see a negative, if I see somebody's heading in a negative direction with things, I tell them, this could be, I don't say the word, I use the word challenging. It's a lot better than you're in trouble. You know, you say to them, wow, what are you going to do? But I do say, I see challenges up ahead. Why don't you try, and I look for ways to avoid it, or try to avoid it. Sometimes it's timing. Let things rest for a while before you act on anything. Sometimes it's get more information before you move on this. Things like that. So try to help them over that bump in the road. And that's why I don't believe in fate. Fate would tell you that this is going to happen. And I don't believe in that. So.
Vince, you say that you know counselors, uh-huh. And they know you, and they couldn't do your job. When is it time for you to turn someone over to someone who can help them? I mean, how do you know when it's time? When you can't help somebody and they need help.
That's a good point. That's a wide range of people. And I know I have suggested counseling for some people. But usually it's because of one of the issues they're going through. Like maybe they're going through a divorce. I say, well, you know, I know a marriage counselor. Why don't you talk with her? Or something like that. And I'll still read them. You know, where I could tell them, you know, see this, I think this would be an opportunity or something good for you to do. But I try to keep that out of the reading. I used to keep a suicide hotline and a whole list of numbers for people in case I had to give a number. I did a psychic line, hotline for about a year. We did that. And so you don't know who you're talking to. And so if somebody you thought was in trouble, you wanted to give them a name, a number, say, well, here, call this a suicide line or something. I never really had the opportunity.